or good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Thank you so much for tuning in today. This is Red Eyes Radio, and I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. It's good to be back with you again. We had a technical issue that arose earlier this week. We actually had a lightning strike take out some of our gear, so we were a bit delayed getting shows up on the regular schedule. Yes, folks, we had a direct visit from Thor, a sign, of course, that he still has power and that he's still a man, despite what the Zemites over at Marvel conjures up. So thank you for your patience as we replaced some of our gear in our studio, took a well-received message from our beloved Norse god and upgraded to a better and more secure setup to be able to continue to record and upload regularly despite hiccups. We have some great shows for you in the pipeline coming up from today and onwards in the next few weeks. I'll share some of those with you at the end of our program today. Our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, has a lot more for you. News and radio programs, videos and analysis, commentary, and other resources to name some of it. Today we're talking with David Icke again. We are going to discuss the Zionist war in Gaza, the situation between the Palestinians and the Jews. We are also going to get into the European situation with mass immigration, culture wars, religiously based conflict, and the order out of chaos that the elite seeks. We're also going to talk about the response to the Zionists targeting Europe. We're going to talk about the preservation of the Europeans and our cultures and heritage in a town like this. Perhaps something you've not heard David talk too much about in the past. So stay tuned. This is a very important topic. And welcome back, David. It's great to talk with you again. Hope you're doing well. You're keeping busy as usual, right?
Right. Yeah, busy's the word, mate. Yeah, it's getting very, very interesting now because so many things are happening and the interest in looking at the world in a different way across all these different aspects of society, not least what's going on in the Middle East, Ukraine, etc., is really exploding, in my experience anyway.
Definitely.
People are becoming more and more open to things they would have dismissed by reflex action before. And that's very, very encouraging. But these are challenging times we're going into. And the more people that can wake up to it, the quicker, the better.
Yeah, exactly. It's about time. We have indeed a lot of work to do. I don't think we've really even realized how much work we do have ahead of us. It is indeed increasing, but the more the better in that regard. And I wanted to talk with you more about Ukraine later, David, but I wanted to just harken back to something that we actually spoke about the first time you were on our show way back in 2006. I remember we talked about Iraq, the situation there. The war at that point had already raged for about 3 years. And we basically reiterated some of the material that you wrote about the fact that they'll be there for good. The U.S. forces is not going to leave to a large extent. And even if they were talking about something like that, they would definitely put in their puppet regime in place and have their players in place. But the reason why I wanted to bring this up is because of something that has happened consequently, both in Iraq and some of the other Middle Eastern countries, when we've seen this massive Zionist occupation of these countries. And now something like ISIS have bloomed up in Iraq, and the whole scenario is just going completely out of hand. And from my point of view, at least, David, this is exactly what the globalists and the elite do best, is to create complete mayhem, complete havoc in as many regions as possible. This is, of course, only causing issues in the Middle East. This is causing issues in the West with mass immigration into the West and everything else. I think they're really ramping up to create a major cultural war as opposed to a hot third world war. What's your analysis of the situation, David?
Well, it's certainly the case that the United States have never left Iraq. To a large extent, they've replaced the in-your-face, they're still there, troops with private armies and security operations that are just answerable to the Pentagon in the very same way that the troops are. It's just that one's in the private sector. So they say it's not Pentagon connected, which absolutely is. They're all aspects of Pentagon control. Third World War. It depends how you define war. I mean, yeah. Third World War is merely a war that affects the world. So this can be a few years and finished, as with the First and Second World Wars, or it can be the Orwellian ongoing war, which is far more likely, to be frank. But what you have is a classic, what I termed problem reaction solution, and what the 33rd degree of Freemasonry calls ordo ab chao, order out of chaos. It's a, if you look at the world, Henrik, over the period that I've been alive, 62 years, it's been a process of creating chaos, and my goodness me, on a scale that we're looking at now, and then creating the order out of the chaos. And the order is the reordering of the world as it was before the chaos. And this has been an ongoing process. And every time it's been reordered, then the world has been more in the image of what the global cabal want the world to be. And so we've seen now a sequence of events in the Middle East where all the order virtually has been destroyed. You had a stable situation in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. It wasn't a nice situation. And of course, he was a bloody man, a bloody ogre. But it was stable. And it's instability that they require so that they can reorder it. So they go into there, justified by the war on terrorism, which was justified by the fake Islamic attack on 9/11. And chaos ensues in Iraq. And that chaos is still there, probably more so now than ever before.
Exactly, yeah.
They've gone into Afghanistan. They've created chaos there. And then they go into Libya. Now, you know, people say what they like about Colonel Gaddafi. There was stability.
Same thing there as with Saddam, you know, so similar.
Exactly. Yeah. He was holding what would have been warring factions, because, you know, we're humans, mate. We can't get on with each other, can we, if we have different bloody beliefs? We can't, you know, it just can't be done. And so he was holding that together. And you know, in Libya was the highest standard of living in Africa.
Yeah.
Then in they go with a classic cabal technique of arming and funding and training so-called rebels. They start shooting at the and attacking government targets. And at that point, the media and the politicians say nothing. And as soon as Gaddafi returns fire, if you like, then suddenly they can't find a microphone quick enough because he's killing his own people. We must protect the people. Yeah. And, of course, they protected the people by pepper bombing them from the sky. And so what's been created in Libya to this day is absolute chaos. That's been, compared with what it was before, bombed into the Stone Age, a phrase that comes up a lot in the Middle East. And then they wanted to take out Assad in Syria, and they tried the same technique. They're still trying it. Indeed, many of the people that were the rebels in Libya were moved across to Syria to do it there. And you have this apparent contradiction, but it's not, of so-called Al-Qaeda terrorists, but so Islamic terrorists in general. That the war on terror was supposed to be trying to challenge and stop, they're actually been among the rebels in both Libya and in Syria. And it seems a big contradiction, but it's not, because the common theme is this. Whatever is best for the agenda, what best suits the agenda in the moment, they will do. So sometimes it's using Islamic terrorists as the reason to invade their countries, and sometimes it's using them to invade countries for you,
as in
Libya and Syria. So, you know, there are no contradictions. There appear to be, but if you know the story, there are no contradictions, because whatever suits the agenda is what they do. Well, one thing about Syria is that I have no doubt they expected Assad to roll over like Gaddafi's regime did, but it hasn't. And I think that's been a big problem for him. And so with all that chaos, along comes ISIS. which they're now calling themselves the Islamic State, I think, you know, whatever they call themselves tomorrow. and that comes virtually out of nowhere, massively funded, armed to the teeth, and starts taking over great chunks of Iraq. And what kind of struck me when that initial burst, Henrik, was going on and they were taking over town after town is the silence from Israel.
Oh, yeah.
The silence from Israel. Now, you know, whenever there's a problem in the Middle East, and here we have this ISIS with this, what it publicly proclaims is this extraordinarily extreme Islamic agenda and wants to take over the whole of what they call the Levant, which includes where? Israel. And so you would see again and again over the years, whenever anything kind of starts to ferment in the Middle East and in the region of Israel, whoever is leading Israel at the time is straight at the microphone. Israel is in danger. Israel's existence is threatened. Yeah. We need to and all that stuff. But this time, silence. Why? Because they knew it weren't going anywhere because they're running it, basically, with the United States. So when you look at what is happening here, and, you know, whenever you have a belief system that is immovable, and whenever you are not at peace with you having that belief system and someone else having a different belief system, even a different version of the same belief system, then you are fodder extraordinaire to be divided and ruled by these people. And I said in books a long time ago that the plan was to play off the Sunni Muslims against the Shiite Muslims to create a massive divide and rule in the Islamic world. Because, of course, if the Islamic world and the Muslim world united together against Israel, it would be all over. But they're not. They're divided and ruled. So here you have this ISIS, or whatever they call themselves tomorrow, that are representing Sunni Muslims, they say. And we have a regime in Iraq up to this point, which was basically dominated by the Shia, the Shiites. And, of course, you have the center of the Shiite Muslim world in Iran. And so there is enormous potential for playing these different, I mean, am I really saying this? You know, is humanity really this mad? This different version of the same religion off against itself, which is what is happening. Yeah. And when you look at the plan long articulated for what is termed a greater Israel, it is breaking up these Muslim states into smaller regions as part of it. And the greater Israel is from the Nile in Egypt across to the Euphrates in Iraq, encompassing parts of Syria and Jordan and all this whole area. And what we're seeing now is all this conflict, all this upheaval, all this confusion, all this chaos. And out of that chaos, they wish to bring the order, which will be the redrawing of the whole of Middle East with Israel as the dominant dictator of that order. Right. That's the idea. So what we're seeing now in Gaza is not, well, I don't have to say that to people that listen to your show, Henrik, but it's not about Gaza. It's not about Israel defending itself. It's about clearing people off the land of Gaza so they can take it back. They're doing it in Gaza militarily, and they're doing it in the West Bank by just building more and more houses for Israelis and knocking down those that are for Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So they're just taking the whole land. And I've said for years, you know, that all these, I mean, I've been around throughout almost most of the period. I was born in 1952. I've been around for almost the entire period of the existence of Israel as a state, 1948. And I've, I was interested in politics as a kid, and my father was interested in politics and this Israeli situation. So I followed it kind of all the way. And you have talks and meetings and Nobel Peace Prizes for people talking to each other. Then you have roadmaps and you have talks about talks. I've been saying all this time, this is just buying time to finish the job of destroying the Palestinians. And that is what we're seeing now. We've come so far along this road that we're now seeing that destruction and we're looking it in the face. But it's been going on since 1948. Indeed, it went on in the run-up to 1948 when Israeli terrorist groups were forcing 800,000 or more Palestinians out of that country, never to return, in sheer terror at what was going on. So it's been a process, and we're now seeing that process reach a certain point, and that point is closing in on their end goal, which is the end of Palestinians in any form, at least in that part of the world now called Israel. And, you know, I did a video cast the other day on my website. I do one once a week on the extraordinary story of the origins of the Israelis in not just in Israel, but in America and around the world. The origin of them, because when you think about it, you know, when you just sit back and you look at things quietly and from the bigger picture and you break it down, you see the most extraordinary things. This whole ongoing conflict involved with Israel since before 1948, when they bombed Israel into existence, it's based on a monumental hoax and lie that today what we now call Israelis have an historic and genetic connection to the land called today Israel, because of an ancient connection to the ancient land, the biblical Israel. And it is a total hoax. And this is not just me saying this. Well, I've been saying it for years. There's Jewish writers like Arthur Koestler, the 13th tribe. There's Shlomo Sand, professor of history at Tel Aviv University, in his book, The Invention of the Jewish People. And all these different aspects of research and researchers come to the same clear conclusion, that today's Israelis originate not from ancient biblical Israel, but from a people in the Caucasus called the Khazars, who had a mass conversion to Judaism in 740 because of their king, King Bulan. And the king of Khazaria was known as the Kagan. That's why Kagan is such a common Jewish name today. And as the Khazar Empire broke up and the former Khazars moved up into Europe, they moved into what is now Russia, what is now Poland, what is now Lithuania, and eventually they moved into Germany. And you know, they didn't speak Hebrew; they spoke Yiddish. Hebrew was only used in the ceremonies of the inherited religion of Judaism. Mm. Yiddish is a makeup language that comes from European. Is influenced by European languages, not least High German, and these people are now called Ashkenazi Jews, which are the vast majority of Jews in the world. So when the Rothschild-controlled Hitler and the Nazis did their stuff in the Second World War in Germany, then these Ashkenazi Jews, not from ancient Israel, but from the Caucasus, then moved into Israel and went across to the United States. And there's some interesting things on this journey, too. The first Zionist conference was in Basel, Switzerland, in the last few years of the 19th century. And it was then that this hoax really started being perpetrated. And the story of the Khazar origins was more and more suppressed. Shlomo Sand, the Tel Aviv University historian, says in his book about the invention of the Jewish people that for a long time, research into the origins of today's Israelis encompassing the Khazar story was quite legitimate. And major Jewish historians were encompassing that story as part of their historical narrative. And then suddenly, bang, no one was talking about it. And suddenly it became something to be condemned for, became something to be ridiculed for, to be dismissed for. And it disappeared. And only a few people today have actually kept it going, like Shlomo Sand, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this narrative again that justifies in their mind today's events, in which there is this unified Jewish desire for what is going on in Israel, and that somehow that the Jews in Germany actually wanted to go to Israel all along. That is absolutely not true. The reason that the first Zionist conference was held in Basel, Switzerland, and not at its original location, Munich, Germany, was because of the enormous opposition that the Zionists had, who wanted to create this homeland in Israel, from Jewish people in Germany, who were saying, "What do you want to go to Israel for? We're fine. It's all right." Then what happened? You had the rise of the Nazis. You had that horrific treatment of Jewish people in Germany. And what happened then? People started heading for Israel and the United States, and you can't blame them in the circumstances.
Well, you had the transfer agreement. I mean, my God, has there been a lot of lies in the Second World War? I've just recently started looking into this, and I'm like, my God. I mean, if people have an idea about, you know, what they talk about when it comes to Gaddafi that you mentioned before, or Saddam, or any of these people who have been so vilified in history, I'm not trying to rectify this in like a 5-minute little rant here, but nonetheless, my God, the lies around the Second World War and Hitler and everything that occurred then, it's just, I've been floored in the last couple of weeks in terms of what the material that actually is available out there, David. I come to realize that obviously when you take things like the transfer agreement into consideration and the way that allegedly there was a plan to get the Jewish people out of Germany and then all these, consequent things occurred, you realize that it's a much bigger picture and a much bigger plan than one we have actually been led to believe. I mean, even the Andinian plan, for example, for a while they wanted to create the Zionist state in Argentina, not in Israel, you know, or Palestine, I should say. So, I mean, there's a lot of these like completely inconsistent little tidbits if we look back and really examine history properly and try to figure out what's going on, you know?
Yeah, and if you put the pieces together, a few things are obvious. First of all, the Jewish people were going nowhere after Germany, or vast numbers of them weren't, other than Israel, because it's part of this Rothschild plan, and to do what they planned, they had to have the Jewish state in among the Muslim world and nowhere else. Because today, what's happening today could not have happened if that had been the case. Now, to justify having the Jewish homeland in Israel and nowhere else, they had to find a cover story to justify it. And then you had this ludicrous story about, I've been talking about the connection to ancient Israel. Load of nonsense. And to keep that story going, you have to suppress the truth, which is the story of the Khazars. So that all kind of fits the story. Then you realize that the Rockefellers in America are a subordinate family to the Rothschilds, but absolutely with the same intent. And, you know, just look at the research of the Rockefeller involvement in the creation of Hitler's race purity movement. They funded whole floor of a university in Germany for a guy called Ernst Rudin, who's one of Hitler's, the Nazis' major race purity people. Because, of course, the Rockefellers, all these bloodlines, are into eugenics. So they were expert in it, and they had experts in it. And they got them out to Germany to start all that. And as a result of that, the outcome was that the Rothschilds got what they want. And that is this homeland for Jewish people in Israel, which has led to all this, what they call the arc of crisis, the arc of conflict. And it was the Rockefellers that paid for the early Jewish settlements. And by the way, no one was more horrified at the massive influx into Palestine of Jewish people from Germany than Jewish people that had lived in Palestine in peace with the Palestinians for centuries. Because their way of life was destroyed, and then in comes this mass influx, and the Parliament building, the Knesset, was paid for by the Rothschilds. The Supreme Court building was paid for by the Rothschilds. They own it. It's their fiefdom. And people like Netanyahu are just puppets for them. The Rothschilds own it, but they have this ability to keep out of the public eye so people don't see it. But that's the story. What's happening in Gaza as we speak is being driven by the Rothschilds. That's the whole point. It's their agenda that's been unfolding. It's their agenda and those close to the spider at the center of the web with them that are behind the what's happening in Iraq with ISIS and what's happening in Ukraine. It's a global plan. And once you see it as a global plan, you see Ukraine's connected to Gaza, et cetera, then you see what's going on. But if you see them in isolation, you won't see the picture.
Let me ask you this a bit as well, more in terms of the Jewish people and this whole issue, because obviously there's debate whether, okay, is the common heritage among Jewish people, is it based on the religion? Is it a genetic issue? If the allegiance is there and dedication, I guess, to the cause, then does it matter if they're Ashkenazim or Khazars or Sephardic or whatever it is, right? It seems to be primarily an ideology, since if you look at the genetic issue, that's been a couple of people looking at that, and that's been kind of falling apart on its own, I believe, as well. But I could be wrong there. But my point being, though, if the allegiance is there and the dedication to, let's say, Israel and the cause of Israel and the Zionist cause, then it doesn't really matter, does it?
Well, it matters in this sense, Henrik. But the fact that Israel exists and all that's come from Israel's existence to this present day is based on a hoax version of history. So it's important in that sense because the whole thing's founded on it. You know, from the start it was understood that there was no genetic or historic connection of today's what we now call Israelis to the land of Palestine, there would have been no justification for what happened, none at all. So that's important in that sense. But in terms of the genetic thing, you know, there has been a number of studies by geneticists over the years that have actually said that in fact, there is no Jewish race as we know it. It's not a genetic thing because, there's been a heck of a lot of in interbreeding with other races and other peoples. And thus, really, there's not really something you could say that, well, this is Jewish genetics, really. And what I would say is that although, you know, you can follow the progression of vast numbers of them out of Khazaria and up through, but I would say that what we call Jewish is actually a mind program, in the same way that I would say what we call Christian is a mind program or what we call Muslim is a mind program. It's a belief. I mean, you can be white middle class and not be a Christian. So Christianity is not a race. It's a belief system. You can be born as an Arab and not be a Muslim because Islam is a religion. It's not a race. It's a belief system. And it's the same with Judaism in all its forms. It's a belief system. And this is why, once again, the true history of where today's Israelis came from historically is absolutely vital to this. A big, massive foundation part of the program, as I would call it, the belief system of the Jewish mind, the vast majority anyway, is that they do descend from ancient Israel, that God did pick them out as the chosen people and did promise them that land. And if you take that out of the belief system, and that they don't believe that because it's shown to be historical nonsense, then that's a big foundation of the program gone. And the self, never mind the collective justification of the creation of Israel, but the acceptance that is the story, and thus justifying your personal behavior. And so where it all came from is very, very important. And in doing so, in uncovering this, and in putting the hoax right, we need to say, well, hold on a second, it's done now. It's not about saying all Jewish people must leave Israel, but it is saying this. Palestinians have absolutely as much, actually more historically, but as much, let's keep it to today, right to be in that land and to have equal rights with you. And if we could go down that road, then we might have a chance of bringing an end to this after all these decades of shocking conflict. But the leadership, the Netanyahus and whoever's in the place, because they're all the same, who are being driven by the agenda of the Rothschilds, don't want that, because the agenda is to get rid of all the Palestinians from that land. And so we have to start, I would suggest, focusing ourselves on the House of Rothschild. Instead of just looking at the oil rag of Netanyahu, unbelievably evil as the man is, let's look at the engineers of it, the Rothschilds. And what I'm trying to do in social media and website and anywhere I can is to turn the spotlight on the Rothschilds, because unless they are flushed out as the people behind this, when Netanyahu goes, someone else will replace him and do the same.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Now, there's much more to discuss here, but there's a secondary effect of all of this that I want to get your take on as well. And that is, as a consequence of a Zionist-run plan, APAC-run foreign policy from America's point of view, of what they're doing in the Middle East, these are not the interests of your regular Westerner or your regular American or European, except those few that are manipulated by the propaganda, I guess, to go to war with these countries or whatnot. But what I'm getting at is that we have a whole lot of wars going on in the Middle East, Northern Africa for a little bit. There are other conditions that are is a consequence of this. And, of course, we have the secondary effect is that we have massive waves of immigration into Europe right now. And I'm very curious of how they're using. Because in this process, they're obviously radicalizing Islam and Muslims as well. And I see that they're using this as a push towards the West and Europe as well, as they are being blamed for part of this. I mean, we have an endless barrage of quotes from Peter Sutherland talking about basically the eradication of the European. Wesley Clark, the former NATO chief, has made similar remarks about how there can't be any ethnically pure states in Europe anymore. We have, of course, the founder of the whole European Union, Kudenhof Kalergi, talking basically about the ethnic cleansing of the European in his book Practical Idealism, if people want to check that out. And that goes way all the way back to 1920s, actually. And so a consequence of this, when we have replacement-level immigration into Europe and into the West at this stage, and we have these high elite-profile people talking about how this will have to be done against Europe, and the radicalization of the Islamic ranks in Europe as, of course, the wars continue, I'm seeing that the secondary level of this, David, is also an attack on Europe as a kind of a... It's almost like they want to create some kind of civil war-type conditions with primarily the aid of religion, but I believe that there's an ethnic basis to this as well. What's your perspective on this, considering what has happened in Europe in the last few years with all these, riots in England and France and Sweden and everything? This is something that's on the ramp up. It's a serious issue that people have to start looking at, I think.
Well, this is why, my main focus in my work is connecting dots, because everything connects to everything else. Just as what is happening in Gaza and this whole ISIS situation is connected to what's happening in Ukraine, so what you've just described is connected to the borders with Mexico of the United States being open to vast numbers of people to come through.
Yeah, that's right.
Again, I've been trying to get across over the years two basic things. Where this cabal wants to take the world and the techniques they use to take us there. And if you can know those two things, then you can start to read the world in a different way. And what they want is a world government dictating to everyone on the planet. They want a world army which would impose the will of the world government. The NATO is being developed to become that, in league with other armies that will fuse together. A world central bank dictating all finance. This is why the financial situation is being crushed and crushed. a world currency, etc. And if you want a world government in which you have the end of the nation state, where under the world government are not nation states, but unions, as we call them today, a North American Union, in the end, an American Union, the European Union, the Pacific Union, etc. We've already got the African Union, and we're seeing them, the Trans-Pacific Partnerships and all these things. They're all part of this bringing groups of people together under the second tier, under the world government, and destroying the nation state. And then they want to break what are today's nation states up into regions and sectors to de-unify any unified response to that edifice of power above. Now, one of the great points of resistance to the end of the nation state is a sense of nationhood. And of course, America, although it's been made up of so many different people coming from all around the world,
at least after 1965, when the immigration laws changed. Before that, it was primarily European. That's just a fact, you know.
Yeah, but what they had is a very strong sense of nationhood of
definitely.
Being American.
Yeah.
Just as the British had a sense of being British and the Swedish had a sense of being Swedish. And that's a big resistance point to the breakup of the nation state. So what they've done, and, you know, you can read it in their writings, the writings of the social engineers they've been using, like the Frankfurt School, etc. Again, Frankfurt, Germany, House of Rothschild.
Primarily Jews are behind the Frankfurt School, though.
Without question. That's historical fact. And they gave us political correctness in so many ways. They talk about mass immigration to break up any sense of nationhood. They want a situation where there is no sense of nationhood anymore. And the number of articles I've seen written in recent years in Britain saying, what does it mean to be British anymore?
Yeah, they're trying to deconstruct that whole ideology. You know, it's amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about. And of course, when you have the human race in great swathes of it anyway, that think that because they believe something or that they do it a certain way that everyone else must do the same, there is tremendous potential, as you indicated earlier, for conflict between different races and cultures when they're actually sharing the same space. And that's the idea, create maximum chaos.
Yes.
And I know, you know, people say it's a fake and all that stuff. But this Albert Pike letter, which was supposed to have been written to another Illuminati bigwig called Giuseppe Mazzini on August the 15th, 1871, Albert Pike, a major, major Freemason in the United States. And he wrote this letter, it is said, and he described that three world wars were coming, and he described the first two. Now, okay, you know, people might say, oh, well, you know, that could have been made up. But so the kind of credibility.
That doesn't take it away. I guess that's kind of like the protocols in a way. Even if if it's a fake, it doesn't take away the predictive quality of it. We can see in a movie predicting the future. It's of the same value, I'd say, in a way, right?
Well, the credibility, surely for anybody, even the greatest skeptic, would be the Third World War, which when it all came to light and up to the present day had not happened, at least not clearly happened. And when you see what he said about the Third World War in relation to what we're talking about now and what's happening in the Middle East with ISIS, with Gaza, worth just reminding ourselves. He said the Third World War must be fomented by taking advantage of the differences caused by the agenteur agency, in other words, of the Illuminati, between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. The war must be conducted in such a way that Islam, the Muslim Arabic world, and political Zionism, as he called it, the State of Israel, mutually destroy each other. That's why I've said to Israelis over the years, you know, they don't care about you anymore. They care about the Muslims. You're just fodder. You're just something to be used. As they were after the Second World War, to give the Rothschilds their land in Israel. Meanwhile, he said, the other nations, more divided on this issue, will be constrained to fight to the point of complete physical, moral, spiritual, and economical exhaustion. This is the multi-level Third World War we're talking about. He said, we shall unleash the nihilists and the atheists, and we shall provoke a formidable social cataclysm, which in all its horror will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism, origin of savagery, and the most bloody turmoil. And, well, of course, we're seeing that in the Middle East, but you're absolutely right when you're indicating the plan for elsewhere.
Yeah.
Then everywhere, the citizens, he said, obliged to defend themselves against the world minority of revolutionaries, will exterminate those destroyers of civilization and the multitude disillusioned with Christianity, whose deistic spirits will from that moment be without compassion or compass or direction, anxious for an ideal but without knowing where to render its adoration, will receive the true light through the universal manifestation of the pure doctrine of Lucifer, brought finally out in the public view. This manifestation will result in the general reactionary movement, which will follow the destruction of Christianity and atheism, both conquered and exterminated at the same time. That what he's talking about at the end there is this kind of one world religion that they want as well.
Yeah.
This global, again, belief system program. And so when you look at that, and you can see the pieces being moved into place that kind of fit what was being predicted there. And, you know, people say, they understandably might say, well, hold on a second. That letter was supposed to be written in 1871. Well, there was no Zionism then. But these people, these insiders, know the projected agenda. And in my books over the years, not least the last one, The Perception Deception, I give a number of clear examples of people who knew what the agenda was and were able to predict so accurately what is happening now, decades and decades ago. George Orwell was one. I'm not saying he was an insider of this. I'm saying he knew because he had access to the Fabian Society, one of the big strands in the web in Britain. And he was a friend of his former French teacher at Eton College, where the royals go, Aldous Huxley. And if you put Brave New World and 1984 together, you pretty much got a massive chunk of what's unfolding now on multiple levels, not least in mind control and use of drugs and mind manipulation techniques and the police state, of course. And there was a guy in 1969 who was a Rockefeller insider called Dr. Richard Day. He was an executive of Planned Parenthood, which actually, of course, started out as a eugenics operation funded by the Rockefellers. And he was talking to a meeting of pediatricians in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1969. And shocked people when he started his speech and asked them to not take notes and to turn off any recording equipment because he was going to tell them how the world was going to change. And he did so. And one doctor did take notes and wrote them up when he got home. And before he died in 2004, he gave a series of interviews, radio interviews or tape interviews, in which he described what Dr. Richard Day had said in 1969. It's unbelievable when you look at what's happening today, what he described in absolute detail.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's no, you know, kind of, it's not something that is impossible that Pike would have known about Zionism in 1871. He absolutely would have done. He would have known about the agenda for Israel. He would have known about the First World War and the Second World War and the Third World War because this is a long-term forward projected agenda. They're not making it up as they go along.
It's very interesting here as well. I think that we have people that seem to think that just ignoring some of these conflict will actually make it go away. I mean, otherwise people think, oh, well, don't participate in it. But the fact is, when you're backed up against the wall and they're holding a knife in their hand, there's like, at some point you realize what you have to either get yourself out of that situation or you have to defend yourself and fight back. People have, for example, criticized me for focusing on these issues and saying that this is a mad plan right in line with all the other things that the elite have been doing at this stage. because they want to try to create these religious conflicts, ethnic conflicts, and everything else. And because I say that the European has a right to fight for its own preservation and will, as all other people have around the world, then this is now how some way an evil plan, right? So what I'm getting at, David, is that we are effectively getting backed up against the wall here. We're in a corner to a certain extent, and we have to act against it, not as a self-defense mechanism. What I'm saying is that, are you really surprised that we've seen a rise of, for example, you know, UKIP in England and Front National in France and, you know, the Swedish Democrats in Sweden, in Denmark, there was another nationalist party, and then people are somehow very worried about this or something like that. But I'm saying it's actually a good thing. It's a thing that where they're pro for the European people, but they're anti-European Union. And this is actually a really positive sign that people of Europe are fed up and have had enough of it, because they don't want these ethnic conflicts. They don't want to have wars in other parts of the world. How do you view this, David?
Well, you know, what most people are looking for in their naivety, given the world we live in, is some kind of perfection from their point of view. So when you have right-wing political groups who are challenging the European Union, although I'm absolutely with them on doing that, you have people saying, yeah, but what about that policy, and what about that policy, and what about that policy? They're looking for perfection.
Yeah.
I'm as far from the right as you can bloody get. I hope I'm as far from the left as you can get, and I hope I'm as far from the center as you can get, because I just don't recognize or engage with that political spectrum, which is an illusion anyway, because the further right you go, you meet the further left. So I am absolutely encouraged by the fact that there is now a political voice for challenging the European Union. But it's, again, these people are not stupid. They're evil, but they're not stupid in an intellectual sense. And so everything is connecting to everything else. And I would say that there's a force behind them anyway, where it's all coming from, which is not even in our reality. And so this political correctness has created the environment in which it is increasingly legal. Never mind you face condemnation for it. The environment says you cannot stand up for the European races.
Yeah.
You can stand up for all the other races.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But you can't stand up for the European races, because that's racism.
Now you're a Nazi, right? You want to kill 6 million Jews. Yeah.
Exactly. And what the irony is, and my goodness me, this world is awash and drowning in ironies, is that those who benefit from political correctness in not being allowed to be criticized are going to be, indeed are, being swallowed up by this global gathering monster state every bit as much as the white Europeans.
Yeah.
And the idea is to play one off against the other, to create the conflict, which creates the chaos, which creates the order out of the conflict. And that new order will not be good for white Europeans, and it will not be good for Muslims, and it won't be good for Indians. It won't be good for anybody apart from the less than 1%. And if we don't start seeing this and stop fighting among ourselves and being divided and ruled by having to have our race or our belief system the dominant one over everyone else, then everyone is going to finish up in the same place. If we do start to see that, then we can start to respect things and respect each other and realize that all cultures have a right to exist, not just some. But there is a war on the European cultures. No
yes.
question about
yes.
it. I mean, you can, I'm sure, talk in far more detail than me about what's happening in Sweden, where this is being so blatantly done there.
Yeah.
And so...
And we have, I just want to mention this, we have people, guys out there listening and gals who haven't seen this yet, just go to YouTube, type in Barbara Spector, and look at the Zionists sitting in Sweden with taxpayer money in a concerted effort, she's talking in this interview, it's a short clip, she's talking to the Israeli broadcasting company about how awfully, you know, anti-Semitic everyone is in Sweden, but they have hope, you know, that this is going to change. But nonetheless, she's mentioning in the video, in the short brief interview, Barbara Spector is her name, she mentions how it's the plan, and again, I'm not saying this, she's saying this, that the Jewish people are going to bring in massive amounts of immigrants into Europe to destroy its, I think the right term is, she's using, it can no longer be the monolithic, homogenous place that it has been in previous years or something like that. She basically mentions that, what the logic is here, I don't know, but this is what she says. If in order for Europe to survive, she says, there has to be basically no ethnically pure, you know, races left in Europe anymore. And so my first question, of course, I've mentioned this before, is, okay, so she has had a meeting with all Jewish people in the world, and they've all agreed to make, you know, Europe multicultural. But nonetheless, the point here being is that it's a very interesting, apparently a contradiction on the surface in all of this, where she, as a Jewish person, is helping to bring in primarily, not only Muslims, of course, but primarily Muslims into a country like Sweden. So, for example, in the third largest city, Malmö, we've had so many issues and riots that from the Islamic community down there, that the Jewish people who've been living in that city are now forced to flee and leave for other parts of, I don't know if they've left other countries or other parts of Sweden, but nonetheless, this is like creating a conflict even against among their own ranks of those of Barbara Spector. But it seems to be that that's more it's more important to sacrifice the comfort and happiness of those few Jewish people, I guess, living in Malmö then, but because the main agenda here is to create a massive cultural conflict with the ethnic Swedes within the country and having Islam as a real and tangible threat to the Swedish culture and our homogeneity. I don't know if you've seen this clip, David, but what do you make of this?
No, I haven't, but I think I may have done, actually. What is said really rings a bell. But this is exactly what we're talking about. Number one, those that are controlling Zionism and the agents of Zionism have contempt for the mass of Jewish people as much as they have a contempt for everyone else. That's what Jewish people need to understand. They are being used as pawns in the game. They were used as pawns in the game in Nazi Germany to create Israel. If what had happened to Jews in Germany had not happened, there would be no Israel because they wouldn't have gone there, as they showed before the war. And here we have Albert Pike. We shall unleash the nihilists and the atheists, and we shall provoke it from formidable social cataclysm in all its horror. That's what they're trying to do everywhere. And so it's worth looking at Zionism, just its structure of Zionism, so we can see what it is. Because one of the great smokescreens is that if you challenge Zionism, you're kind of anti-Semitic, which is another ridiculous thing. Because the Khazars were not a Semitic race, and the vast overwhelming majority of Semitic races in the world, which is not a race, it's actually a language group. That's what Semitic refers to. Are actually the Arab races of the Middle East. You couldn't make it up, really. What Zionism is the way it plays out publicly on the public stage, it's a political movement. It's a political movement that believes in a homeland for Jews in Israel, actually based on an historical hoax perpetrated largely by the Rothschilds. But there is another level to Zionism, and this is the real one. The inner core of Zionism is actually a secret society. It's a very elite secret society that locks into the other secret society web and all the others. But the inner circle of Zionism is very, very close to the spider, and it's dominated by the Rothschilds. Now, let's just break this down in terms of numbers. You talk about the less than 1% people talk about the 1% that are running things. Well, in America, there are less than 2 million Jews, less than 2 million. It's less than 2% of the population.
Yeah, exactly.
What I meant to say. And less than 2% of the population. So within that less than 2%, there will be a serious number who won't be Zionists at all. I mean, you've seen all the protests against Zionism during the Gaza invasion is what it is. Then there will be a great chunk of that 2% who will be, if you like, watching from a distance, Zionists who buy the program but watch from a distance. And then that leaves a tiny, tiny, tiny number that are actually connected to the secret society compared with the number of Jews in general. And from that number that are directly or one or two step back connected to that inner circle where the Rothschilds are, will be ridiculously few. And yet you look at the ratio of Jewish people in positions of significant power in America, in government, in banking, in business, in media, in Hollywood, all over the place. And you'll see that it's not just that they come from 2% or less than 2% of the Jewish people or the American people, but they come from a fraction even of that. And then you see the same in European countries. The number of Jewish people in New Zealand, I think it's 0.17%, and yet they got the prime minister. So you see this all over the place. When we are challenging Israel, yes, we're challenging the Israelis that support the Israeli policies because they've been programmed from birth to support madness. But actually what we're really challenging is a tiny few people compared with the global population, Henrik, of billions and billions. Mm-hmm. It is the most stunningly small ratio or number of that, percentage of that, that is actually driving all this. But because they compartmentalize their organizations so that the vast majority within any organization, whatever it may be, government, bank, anything, have no idea what the true agenda of it is, they are every day going to work or going to government or whatever and making their contribution to creating a world fascist nightmare Orwellian state for themselves and their children and grandchildren without having any idea that that's what they're doing. And when you break it down, the number of people who are actually driving this, not playing it out by saying, yes, sir, I'll introduce this policy, but actually deciding what the policy is going to be, is absolutely shocking in how small it actually is. And Zionism at the secret society level is one of the major, major drivers of it, because it's nothing to do with Jewish people ultimately. It's about using Jewish people, using a fake history to create changes in the Middle East and elsewhere that will bring about the agenda the Rothschilds have worked so long to introduce.
Let me follow up on that a little bit, because I was looking at a documentary the other day called Defamation from 2009. It was made by a Jewish guy. I forget his name now, but I was amazed to see in that he was actually deconstructing, was like kind of a behind the scenes of the ADL and, you know, all the activities of Abe Foxman and all these people.
Yep.
And I was amazed to see how many of the young Jewish people in this documentary that they showed are actually programmed into believing that they're the world is basically full of just frothing at the mouth European Nazis. They just have no other yep. desire in life than to find, torture, and murder as many Jews as they can. I mean, there's a mind control program going on here in terms of the type of tribalism they're seeking to create for a lot of these Jewish young people. Because, I mean, what I saw in that documentary, it was like, my God, it was like a couple of scenes there where there were miscommunication between a couple of older Poles, I think. They were actually going to one of the alleged extermination camps in Poland, and there were a couple of older Poles sitting there, and there was some miscommunication between some of the younger Jewish people that were there and then the older Polish gentleman. And it was just amazing. There was as such, these young people were absolutely convinced that everyone that was out there was a Nazi that wanted to murder them. And I was like, my God, they're using their own children and programming them in such a way so that there will be this lifelong dedication to the ethnic interests of Jewish people. It's actually a strategy, and they're using their own children in this. I was amazed to see that.
Yeah, because the goal is what concerns them, not the means of getting there. That's the thing. And like I say, Jewish people in general are looked upon with just as much contempt as anyone else. when it comes to this inner circle of the Zionist secret society. And, you know, when you've got a situation, and this is an extraordinary thing I saw some years ago now, when the Israeli government is putting advertisements out in places like America on TV and elsewhere, urging Jewish people not to marry non-Jewish people, but to, in effect, keep the blood pure, is what they were saying.
Yeah.
That is the extraordinary level of racism. But what they have managed to do by manipulation and inversion, and by controlling the sources of communication overwhelmingly, is to be the most racist creed on earth while actually painting everyone else as racist against them. And when I say them, I don't mean all Jewish people. I'm talking about this circle that's driving it. Now, the Anti-Defamation League came out of B'nai B'rith. B'nai B'rith, Anti-Defamation League, Rothschild. And they and things like the Wiesenthal Center and the Canadian Jewish Congress and all these others.
SPLC and all these
the
groups.
Board of Jewish Deputies in Britain. Like the fake history of today's Israelis, you A, have to produce the fake history, but then you have to suppress the real history so the fake history can prevail. In the same way, when you are a tiny network of people at the center in this Zionist secret society around the Rothschilds, who are to such a large extent driving the direction of the world, who are controlling the banks and governments and the media and Hollywood and all the rest of it, you have got to have a mechanism to stop that coming out. You have. And that mechanism is to create organizations like the Anti-Defamation League and these others we've talked about that target anyone that talks about it as racist. I mean, personally, I haven't got a racist cell in my body. I think racism is not only horrific, I think it is childish beyond belief. And it is the most obvious and blatant confirmation of a complete misunderstanding of the nature of life and reality.
You know what? I think that these issues actually arise when they're trying to deny the clear and, ethnic and cultural and hereditary differences between us. It's again when they're seeking to create this kind of one world glob of one monoculture steeped in corporatism and empty,
Everything. Yeah. They want mono agriculture, mono culture, mono religion, mono political control.
Exactly, and that's what they're attempting to do. And I think that when they're in this attempt, when they're doing this, that is what actually is creating the true and problematic situations between various races and ethnic groups and everything else. Because I mean, my God, as you mentioned, the double standards here that. You know, Israelis have the right to do everything that everyone else doesn't. So if you want to, marry a Swede, now you're a racist. If I, as a Swede, want to marry a Swede, I'm the racist, But of course, Israel and Israelis, they have the right, of course, actually encouraged only to marry with their own, right? So it's about exposing all of these double standards that apply to others, but primarily not to, let's say, Europeans or Westerners or something like that. And that's where the lie is. And that's where the real issues arise as well, when people see this in a clear light,
Yeah, and when you control the sources of communication, or mass communication anyway, you see these double standards everywhere. For instance, you see the coverage in the Western media of what's happening in Gaza. I mean, it's extraordinary. The difference in firepower, the difference in casualties that are going on there, and yet it's in so many ways it's being reported as like an equal contest. It's a war. It's not a war. A war needs two sides. And in the same way, what you're talking about, saying Israelis must only marry Israelis. Well, that's fine, but to say it with any other group of people is racist. It's all like that, but that's the way it's set up.
Yeah.
And it's run by fear, So many people who know these things, They won't speak about them as we're speaking about them now.
And they have to. They have to begin to speaking about this. Otherwise, this will control you. This will regulate your life. You won't be. Are you going to pussyfoot around all these issues all your life? It's not going to work. It's time to face them head on and realize, yes, you know, Europeans and Westerners are being targeted just as other you know, people have been targeted in the past. Right now, here's where the pressure lies. Realize it. And if you stick your head in the sand, it's not going to go away. It's actually going to get worse. And it's time that we all stand up and defend ourselves in the scenario of how we're being targeted right now. That's what I believe anyway.
Yeah, well, it's like I've said before, you know, ignorance is bliss, but only for a while. You can put your head in the sand when a tornado's coming to try to ignore the fact that a tornado's coming, but your ass is still in the air and the tornado's still coming. And if you lifted your head from the sand and faced the tornado, you could take avoiding action.
Yeah.
But if you stay where you are, you're going to be spinning in the air very shortly. But people are frightened into silence. Because they are frightened of being dubbed racist and anti-Semite and all that stuff.
Right.
Now, personally, I've taken so much abuse from so many sources ongoing to the
minute.
Yeah,
you have. You have.
But I
sure.
couldn't care bloody less what anyone says about me. I know the way I see the world. I mean, when you look at my, if you like, spiritual philosophy, in the nature of reality. I'm saying the body is just a vehicle for infinite awareness. It's a biological computer. It's a holographic biological computer. That's why I say anyone that judges people by their race is an idiot in terms of understanding reality. But it's not about that. It's about taking the perceptions of race and perceptions of racial and cultural differences, which there are. Course, people,
and there's beauty in that, David, too.
There is beauty in that.
You know, these differences are wonderful. I love this. I mean, to be able to go to Japan and, you know, experience everything of Japanese culture and everything else. And I mean, okay, sure, that's actually there right now, but they're working very hard of eradicating that there, too, in the same way as they have in the European countries. I mean, I'd love Englishness just to experience that when I go over there. I don't anymore. It's like it's not there. I hate that.
Well, I know what you mean about that, and I'm absolutely with you on that. It's something I've been banging on about for a long time. That although you know we are infinite awareness, we're all the same expression of infinite awareness. Infinite awareness is another term for infinite possibility. So diversity is to glorify in infinite possibility, and therefore I love it. I mean, when you travel around and you see different cultures, you see people doing things in different ways. These are all the glorious tapestry of human experience.
Yes, yes.
But what they want to do is create the blob. They call it, multiculturalism, but actually what they want is one culture.
Monoculture, exactly, yeah.
Monoculture. So I guess everything's inverted. You know, it's another thing. When you look at the world, you look at any situation, almost every time, you have to invert it to see what's really going on, because what you're looking at in the way it apparently seems is almost always the opposite of what the truth is. Let's have the glorious tapestry of different expressions of all possibility. I want that. And, you know, this blob, this monoculture is being driven by centralization of power, which is called globalization. You know, what I want is diversity of power. I want power devolved to communities, to the individual, so that they can express themselves as they wish to express themselves, as long as they respect the rights of other people. But instead, we're seeing it going the other way. And every time you take a step closer to the center, fewer and fewer people are dictating the lives of more and more.
Yeah.
And you know where they're talking about independence for Scotland and things like that. Oh yeah, that appears on the surface to be something that's devolving power. It's not. It's start. And I'd be all for it. But what it's doing, it's preparing the ground for the European Union of regions with the breakup of nation states. That's what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see a truly independent Scotland, but those that are saying, yeah, we want independence for Scotland, you know, like the First Minister, Alex Salmond, they're saying within the European Union. Well, if you're within the European Union, you ain't independent, mate. There's no way you're going to be an independent Scotland. We're not an independent United Kingdom. It's not an independent France. You go down to the level of Scotland in terms of numbers, they'll eat you alive, mate.
That's right. Exactly. It's a facsimile. So it's in a way, I mean, we understand that the nation state served their purposes for a while because, I mean, we have to recognize in that, I mean, I like the nation state, don't get me wrong, but if we go back further back in history, we realize it was more broken up than that. It was more local communities. It was different cultures within these nations. And then primarily after the Second World War, they really worked on like eradicating, you know, dialects in different ways or cultural, you know, differences that occurred within the nation. It was kind of a homogenization of the nation. But at least at this state, that's what we do have as a kind of a somewhat of a border of holding back the insanity of something like the European Union, for example. But now it's like erode the nation, dissolve it into the European Union, and then, just as you said, David, kind of go back to this kind of a smaller local tribe within the European Union. And it doesn't matter squat, whatever system we have in place after that, if we're going to be centrally ruled by a world government, by the European Union, or you know, whatever it is after that point.
Yeah. I mean, people in the end are actually, if they are going to understand the world they live in and where it's all come from and what's behind it, they've got to understand that there is a unseen force that is the common theme over thousands and thousands of years that has been driving the world in a certain direction. And the politicians and all these other people are here today, gone tomorrow, gophers for that hidden force. And once you realize that, you start to realize that this process of unfoldment in the human story has actually, at its core, not been random, but calculated and coldly calculated. And what you've just brought up is an example of that. If the few are going to control the many, then you have to centralize decision making. You can't do it if there's too many points of decision making, no central few are going to dictate it. So when this, what I would say, hijack by a non-human force happened, there was a process to go through to bring us where we are now. And in the far, 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 far ancient world, as you've just been talking about, Henrik, people organized themselves in small groups, long ago in very small groups. And then those small groups started to come together in tribes, and now someone is dictating the tribe largely, although not always, but you know, it can be more open, but largely there are dominant characters that dominate the tribe through the generations. And then we came to this point where lots and lots of tribes were brought together into what were called nations. And now a few at the center of the nation are dictating to all the former tribes. And what we're seeing now is simply the ongoing continuation of this process, which is of nation states being brought together in groups called unions, which are controlled by a few at the center that are dictating to all the former countries that were dictating to all the former tribes, etc. It's been a process, and it's been a calculated process to bring about this centralization of power that allows the few to control the many. And it's the idea is to take it one step further and bring in the world government level of this so that the unions that now dominate the countries are themselves dictated to by the world government. And people have this kind of naivety. You know, I said in one of my books that naivety is one of the great human curses, because they see all these evil things going on in the world, but because they can't, they're too naive to see that they're all connected.
Yeah,
they are being dictated to by an evil force in the shadows. But all the evil expressions of this force in their daily lives and on the television every day are dismissed as random coincidence. And that's why they don't get it. Once they realize that all these things are actually being driven to a common aim by a common force, then people can start to get it and realize what's actually happening, because it's not random. It's calculated. It's all connected.
Well, exactly. Indeed, we're going to wrap up in a little bit here, David, but a couple of more points here. I mean, it's this idea that people have, just what you said before, you know, it's an application of a spiritual line of thinking onto a physical necessity of what we have here that kind of makes a disassociation between that concept of our spiritual world with reality that kind of clash, because people are like, oh, wonderful, because we're all one anyway, right? So it doesn't really matter. But my point is, how should a British businessman in you know, who's on par with or in Brussels working for the European Union know what a Romanian farmer needs, or you know, a New York stockbroker knowing what a fisherman in Malaysia should have, if we're talking about a world government
or
something like that?
It's nonsense.
Yeah, it's garbage.
It's not nonsense if that's your goal, to create a centralized world.
Right.
And you know, so much of what happens is dismissed as bureaucratic incompetence when it's actually bureaucratic cold calculation. And they really do love it when the public dismisses apparently crazy decisions as bureaucratic red tape nonsense, when actually it's coldly calculated to bring about an end. And this is why it's so important for people to realize what that end is. If you understand where they want to take us, then you can see the steps to take us there. It becomes easy. But if you dismiss blindly and suicidally, actually, that there is a coordinated plan here, then you're never going to get it, because all you'll see is apparently random events that have no connection.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I actually think that the secession, if you will, then, or separation, breaking up into smaller factions, free from centralized control, actually is the true way of the future, so that you can live as you want, with whom you want to live, not being forced either to, you know, being side by side by a cultural group that has evolved and developed a religious and cultural and heredity for possibly, you know, thousands of years, and expect you know, to everything be nice and dandy. I mean, that's part of that naivety that you talked about before, that you can just smash all of this together and then expect to, you know, oh, it's going to be great, you know, when you can't even communicate and understand the people around you. It's craziness. It's madness.
Yeah, but you know, if people are unconscious, they don't see anything consciously, do they?
No.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
And the system, right the way from leaving the womb, is designed to put people in states of unconsciousness, so they don't consciously see anything except what they're told to see. And you know, again, when you sit back, take a step back and look at it, you come into the world, and within 3 or 4 years, and they want to make, I mean, there's some monumental idiot involved in education in this country with a government agency who's saying that children should be going to school at 2.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. What? Why? Because you've got control of their minds earlier and earlier and earlier. So you come out of the womb in a moment, 3 or 4 years, you're in school, and some authority figure is telling you what to think, what to do, when you can leave, when you can't leave, when you can go to the toilet, when you can't. You're sitting at a desk. You can't leave. You have to stay there for a certain amount of hours until you're told you can leave. And this goes on all the way through your formative years, where the state has control of your mind for longer than your parents' interaction
yeah,
does.
Yeah. It's amazing.
You then go through college and university, and the only way you can be successful at doing that is to tell the system in exams what the system has told you to believe. Then you go out into the world. You go out into the world where now there's a boss telling you what to do and what not to do. If you are a boss, then the bank's doing it. And there are rules and regulations galore, more by the hour, all over the world, dictating every fine detail of your life. And then you die. And that's called human life. Now, that is insane. And I have a simple philosophy. Do what you like, so long as you don't impose it on others. That's the only law we need, you know.
Yeah.
We don't need any more. It's not a law. It's a way of living.
It's a moral code of conduct. That's what it is.
That's all you need. Because, you know, do what you like, so you can murder people, can you? No, hold on. do what you like, so long as you don't impose it on anyone else. And that means imposing your will, imposing yourself on their space, imposing yourself on their belief system, imposing yourself on their way of life. And if we could just respect, that's the word that's missing, respect everyone's right to be themselves, so long as they don't impose it on anyone else. And mature, conscious people can do that. Then we don't need rules and regulations. We don't need bloody governments. We just need the organization to make things happen. That doesn't mean we need rulers. We need organization. And we can get on with our lives. And you know, I don't care what people do so long as they don't impose it on anyone else. If Henry Kissinger wants to sacrifice George Bush, I say, you know, feel free. And then when George Bush leaves the body, he'll realize what an idiot he is. Well, he'll probably realize it already before even going that far. In other words, you know, take your experience and then learn from your experience, but don't impose your experience on anyone else. And we can live like that, a world without rules. What was it? What was that line in The Matrix? A world without rules. Yes, we can have a world without rules as long as we are conscious. You don't need rules to say you cannot murder if you wouldn't even think about doing it. You don't need environmental rules saying you can't damage the environment if you wouldn't even begin to think about damaging the environment. What we have, Henrik, is an unconscious world, and thus an unconscious world does things that are unconscious in terms of their intelligence. When we have a conscious world, people will do conscious things because of their innate intelligence and will live in a completely different world. But until people reach that point, we're going to go on in the direction we are. Fortunately, there are the first tangible stirrings of some kind of mass re-engagement with re-evaluating the world they thought they lived in, which is great, fantastic.
All right, very good, David. We'll begin to wrap things up on that note for this time. I think that's a good way of ending here for this time. Hey, by the way, please let us know if you have anything new going on, if you have any upcoming talks or anything like that.
Mention your latest
book again and give us the website, David.
Well, I've got a real big one, Henrik. The Wembley Arena on October 25th.
Yeah.
It's not being live streamed, so you know it's a live event. It starts at 9:30 in the morning and goes through to about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. I'm going to be going right the way through, dot connecting through the nature of reality to how that explains what's happening in the world, to what is happening in the world and to what end. And then we've got the last section, which is about, okay, what do we do about this and about opening ourselves to that consciousness I'm talking about. And we've got, it's a massive, music, dance, we've got a drumming group, shamanistic drumming group. We've got, a great band called The Ancient Order coming over from Canada. We've got another great band called Rebel Control. My son Gareth Ike is a professional musician. He'll be playing there. And it's just going to be, a fantastic vibe, because in the end, it's important. And I would say this, Henrik, in relation to something you mentioned quite early in this chat.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about ignore it. We have to know the nature of the problem, i.e. what's happening and the techniques and the goals and everything, if we are going to be able to solve the problem. You can't solve a problem you don't understand. So that is when people say, oh, well, what about the solutions? Well, knowing the problem is a massive part of the solution.
Yeah.
But in the end, the solution is about frequency. We have been pulled into a distorted low vibrational frequency that is a state of unconsciousness. And to get our true self back, we have to open and expand our awareness and raise our frequency. Like one radio station is on such a high frequency that a low frequency radio station can't interact with it. And then this distortion, this crazy world that we are playing our part in creating, because we are locking in at a frequency level into it, then we can detach ourselves from it and cease to be influenced by it, and thus we start to see in a much more clear and a greater clarity than ever before. So the Wembley event is about going through that entire process over a day, through the nature of reality, through the problem and how it works, so we understand that, but then crucially into the fact that it's our vibrational state, which comes from our mental and emotional and spiritual state, that is the answer. Because the problem is we've been pulled into an energetic distortion of very low frequency and states of unconsciousness. We have to wind ourselves out of that and set us free from that. And that's not through the intellect. It's through the heart, and it's through expansion of awareness and expansion of consciousness. And I go into this in the Perception Deception, which is the biggest book I've ever written. It's nearly 1,000 pages and about 1,000 illustrations, or 900. If I died today, that would still be the best thing I've ever done. Perception Deception. But Wembley is, we did it 2 years ago, and the energy of getting thousands and thousands of people together in one place who are of like mind with open hearts, it's a truly, truly special experience, I can't tell you. October the 25th.
All right, very good. DavidIke.com, obviously that's the website. Look at the tickets there for the talk at Wembley, October 25th. Check out the book, Perception Deception, and also check thepeoplesvoice.tv for the network that David started up. All right, David, well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk with you soon again, okay?
Okay, mate, and if you want to come to Wembley, Henrik, then, you know, be our guest.
Oh, definitely. I'd love to come. Definitely. Okay, folks. Thank you for listening to our extended one-hour segment with David Icke today. I urge you to look into World War II history, as I mentioned during the program, and to do so from sources that at least have an ounce of objectivity, free from Allied and Soviet propaganda. This is, of course, very difficult to do and quite a task to get involved in, since there are so few of these sources out there and available today. But they are there, and we're going to continue to address some of these in future shows as well. But, you know, the victors write the history, folks, and you know this. So why continue to suck up the Hollywood version of the Second World War and the way they continue to demonize Germans and Germany to this day, even? You might be able to see it with Saddam in Iraq, Gaddafi in Libya, Ahmadinejad in Iran, as we talked about with David, but why not with Germany? Listen, you're free to believe whatever you want to believe, of course, but just know that you might be living a lie, as you're stuck in the world that the forces today ruling the world constructed for you, and all of us really, after the end of the war in 1945 and 46, and that has continued to mythologize and exaggerate ever since. We'll address some of this in future programs, so please keep this in mind, and please keep an open mind and continue to think and process the information you do hear about. Question the sources and the motives of those providing you with the information they want you to believe. In a time when our governments are clearly occupied by foreign interests, Zionists, frankly, people are still running around looking for Nazis hiding under their beds that are secretly controlling the world in some mysterious and usually unexplainable occult way. I think it's time to open your eyes and see what is right in front of you. Don't miss the forest for all the trees. We have John Lash coming up on the program. He is going to be back with us for a two-part program, a mini-series on why we need to go to war and how we are going to go to war against the forces that are seeking our demise. Do not miss this. We also have Ricardo Duchesne for a return, Max Egan, Gary Biltcliffe, and Gordon Kennedy. Don't miss our Radio 314 program with Warren Farrell on the myth of male power, another excellent program with Lana. For today, we say thank you for listening. We'll be back in just a few days. Take good care and have a great weekend. Bye-bye.